Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello there, I'm Richard Gagoy. Here's what's coming up on Focus on Africa. How a young Ugandan techie was lured to a scam camp in Myanmar.
I got linked up through a mutual friend to some Chinese agent. Then when we looked up the company online, the company was legit. They processed my visa and ticket. It was supposed to be a six-month contract.
Also, South Africa's opposition party under fire over requests for international election observers.
They haven't shown any evidence that really supports their concerns to say why South Africa needs all these international observers and, of course, also domestic observers to increase their numbers.
And we'll tell you why Ghana is offering tax rebates to filmmakers.
Ghana is actually the second largest producer of content on the continent, following Nigeria. Quite a number of big budget films have been shot in Ghana, from Beast of No Nation to Deadly Voyage that I myself was in.
It's Tuesday, the 12th of March. Let's start in Kampala. You would remember the story of 30 Ugandans who are trapped in scam camps in Myanmar. According to the UN, they're just a fraction of the estimated 120,000 who were duped by human traffickers with the promise of lucrative jobs, only for them to be held in horrifying conditions in setups resembling labor camps. The last time we brought you this story, Uganda's Minister of State for Foreign Affairs, John Mulumba, told us the government was working to rescue and repatriate nationals held in those camps. A non-governmental organization helping victims of human trafficking told us the camps are in areas controlled by the military in Myanmar. Our colleagues from BBC Burmese put these allegations to the authorities, who denied this and instead referred us to the Chinese government. Francis Kamugisha was lucky to escape after 7 months in captivity. So how did he pull it off? And how did he end up there in the first place? Here he is narrating his ordeal to Audrey Brown.
By that time, I was living in Dubai and tried to find a permanent job there. So I got linked up through a mutual friend to some Chinese agent. Then when we looked up the company online, the company was legit. It had a website, like everything was legit. The company was called Bebe Technologies. They processed my visa and ticket. It was supposed to be a six-month contract.
And where were you going to?
I was going to Laos.
So you were going to Laos, and what were you going to do there?
It was a data management job. Professionally, I'm an IT person, so I had to manage their back-end data.
And how much were you going to be paid for this, if you don't mind me asking?
That promised me a net of $1,500 per month, plus commissions and allowances.
So did it all seem kosher and above board, or was there something slightly unusual that made you think, I wonder what this is? Or were you completely comfortable and happy with everything?
No, I was completely comfortable because I couldn't suspect anything. Everything she told me, I checked it out and I rechecked out.
What was her name?
Her name was Mickey.
Right.
But because of maybe the language, we never managed to speak much about ourselves, like, you know.
But you did meet in person?
Yes, we did meet in person.
Did you sort of, you know, do due diligence checking with people, like, what are these people like? Do they give you the money?
In Laos, the part they told me when I searched about it was really okay. It was okay in Laos. When I searched about it, it was okay. Like, it was okay for everyone to be there. There was no racism, there was no segregation. Like, it was really a nice place to be in.
You get to Laos, and then what happened?
Like, everything was fine. These people greet me, like, we're coming from the airport, take me to the hotel. There are many people, but it was kind of like a lab setup. So I sat there, they told me the boss was not around. The boss would be coming like in a 2 weeks' time. When the boss appeared, they brought in a contract which was really different from our agreement, and I couldn't accept it.
Yeah, what was different on it?
I was supposed to be scamming. They started telling me you have to manage your clients, do I talk to them, chat with them, they give us money. And there was no payment for it. There was no payment for that.
Was it romance scamming, or was it like what we traditionally call the 419, or what was it?
Romance scamming.
So did you do it, or wait, in the 2 weeks that you were waiting for the boss to come and you saw your contract, or were you doing something else first and then you discovered what they wanted you to do and you refused to do it?
So I would wake up, go to the lab and sit there all day. like normal activities, but I was doing nothing. Then when the boss came, I disagreed the contract. They told me to pay them 16,000 RMB. And they said I had to fend for myself, like feeding, or I had to work to support that so they can feed me and do that. I had no other option apart from working for them.
So why did you owe them money? Was it because of the ticket and the flight and staying there for 2 weeks that you owed them money?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it was about the expenses that they incurred to transport me to that place. Like, the amount they told me was much more than the actual cost of the ticket and a visa and one.
So what did you do then?
I worked for them. I sat there, waited for 2 months.
So tell us a little bit about what you did.
Many people may know it as pig butchering. It's a love scam. You kind of fall in a relationship of a sort. Then in the end, this person is not real. This person may be a model or what. And the person may introduce business to you, which is always in the form of investment, and they take your money just like that.
So were you good at it?
I wasn't good at it, but I had to be good at it to survive there.
So did you manage to scam people out of money?
Definitely I did. Otherwise, they wouldn't have ended well for me. I did.
So you say it wouldn't have ended well for you. What do you mean?
Once you're there, you don't own your life. Especially after I crossed to Myanmar. Myanmar is different. Like, you're told you're a slave. Yeah, we own you. We bought you. They tell you to do anything according to them. You're not regarded as a human being.
How did you end up in Myanmar?
I was told I was being like transferred to the company. I was going to do IT work because I had refused to sign that contract. And I was really being a problem to that company. And they told me that found me an IT job, like an IT company. They didn't tell me IT job. They just saw IT company where transferring you, where you'd be doing IT work. And they didn't tell me the exact location. So going there, we had to use a boat to go there. And reaching there, that's when I realized I was in Myanmar.
In other interviews, you talk about being very badly treated, being beaten, being chained for being unproductive. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Did it happen?
Yeah, it did, like, especially being beaten. To work, you sit and someone's just playing the taser on your back.
A taser?
Anytime, even if
electrocuting
electric taser. Yes, like, especially, like, waking you up to go and work. It's not that they would tap on you until you wake up. It was real rough inside that place. It was real rough. What hurt me was, like, reaching there, most of these guys who are like the security guards who would come to wake us up and do all that crap, the person is younger than you, not educated. Like, it was really annoying, and you had nothing to do about it. The security guards are Burmese. The Burmese people definitely will do anything they are told to do because they will tell you they need the money.
And who were the
because
big bosses?
We had the big bosses were Chinese and these Burmese people.
Who were the other people with you? Where were they from?
By the time I was there, we had Thai people. We had people from Malaysia. We had Nepalese. And the main person who I was with was a South African guy, like the person I would speak English with.
And how many people would you say in total were there?
Maybe around like 700. In some companies, we didn't meet some people. And at times, doing different work. Some would be doing, like, extraction. By extraction, I mean, like, finding clients. Others are chatting them for romance, and others are chatting them for business.
So you work, you wake up, go to work, go to sleep. Did that happen 24/7, 7 days of the week?
That's all, yeah.
That's work, all you did,
sleep,
every day?
Work, sleep, yeah.
What kind of food were you given? Was it okay?
We had one meal after work. Then around morning, we had a simple breakfast. So 2 meals per day. Breakfast had a bowl of noodles, and lunch had like rice and other things. And that was all.
And no time off?
No time off.
Payment?
No payment. There's no payment. You slept there. There's no payment.
So that 1,500, nowhere to be seen.
You had to give it up in the first place. Now you had to focus on liberating yourself.
So you don't have any money, right? Because you were expecting to make money.
And I don't have any money. I've not been paid. Like, I don't have any money. And they tell me to pay 10 million baht.
So did you talk to the people that were around you? Did you find out how they ended up where you were?
Some of them had phones, and maybe would chat using their phones.
How long were you there for?
I was there for around 7 months. That's in Myanmar alone, then around 2 months in Laos.
You escaped. Tell us how you did that.
It happened so fast. It wasn't planned. It happened so fast. We just landed on a chance. These people took us out of the compound and took us to a military barracks. We met someone, started chatting the person, like waiting for the sergeant who we were waiting for to come to tell us our cases and what. Like, he told us he would transport us up to the river, and that would be all.
So why were you taken to a military base?
Many organizations were talking to the Myanmar authorities, and like the way these Chinese are kind of connected to those people in authority in office, and they got to know that some organizations, it was like some people were looking for us, and they didn't know which people were looking for us. But because I had also talked to the American embassy and also the British embassy, they suspected that the American embassy was down looking for us. We didn't know why they took us to the military barracks, but I think the military person we were meeting was kind of like their fixer for them, like it was a fixer.
You said you spoke to the American embassy and the British embassy. Did you speak to the Ugandan embassy? Did they do anything to try and help you? Did you approach them?
Yes, they actually did, because they also had a meeting with the Myanmar embassy in Malaysia. Because the place we were in was really inaccessible by all international organizations and institutions, and they had a meeting with the embassy on Myanmar in Malaysia, and they tried to help a lot.
This was the Ugandan government, right?
The Ugandan embassy in Malaysia.
There you are. Somebody is taking you in a boat down the river. And then what happened?
No, actually, that was the scariest 20 to 30 minutes, I can say.
Okay, because, tell me why.
As you know, by that time, there was insecurities along the border of Thailand and Myanmar, and we are coming from that route. And we didn't know what these people had planned for us because of the language barrier. They would just bring us a phone, translate things, and we either say yes or no. During transportation, we didn't know what was happening. I mean, like, we just knew we are going here, but we didn't know what they are planning. We had talked about being rescued, but we didn't trust these people. We didn't know what was going to happen, especially along that river. Many things happen along the river. The Chinese always to scare us that they would take us. Whenever they did something, they just say they would take you to the river, something like that. And when they take you there, then that means that's your end.
Who were you with when you were being taken on this boat? There were just two of you?
Two, me and the South African guy.
What was the South African guy's name?
He was called Eddie.
Right. Black or white South African?
Eddie Morey. He was a white South African.
And he
was around 53 years of age. He was laid about being a manager of a casino around that same place.
So you got to the other side of the river.
Getting to the side of the river, we had no money. We had nothing on us. We had no documentation. When you just entered the guest house and asked for food and what. And luckily enough, we are talking to the IGM in Thailand, who was really very helpful at the time.
And who is IGM?
IGM is International Justice Mission. Actually, we had contacted police, but it came after like 4 days. When they came, we did an interview with them, and they told us they would be back in other 4 more working days. And it took them 3 months to come back.
So for 3 months, you were there in this guest house. Where was the guest house? Are you back in Laos now, or are you still in Myanmar?
Yeah, we are in Laos, in Phung, just at the riverbank.
Okay.
Because when they dropped us the river, we had nowhere to go.
So how did you finally end up back home?
That was after 3 months. Eventually, my paperwork came out and I left.
So who paid for your fare from Laos to Uganda?
My ticket was paid for IOM.
And when did all of this happen?
That was around last year. Because I came last year in July.
When you got back to Uganda, did you have any contact with the government? Did you have a debrief, anything like that? Counseling?
Nothing. It was a fresh start for me.
Francis Kamugisha in Kampala. The move by South Africa's opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, to request for international help in monitoring upcoming elections has sent political shockwaves across the country. In a letter, the DA requested the United States, the European Union, and other Western governments to provide resources for independent domestic observers ahead of the May 29th elections. Now, this year's polls will be held amid high unemployment and widespread disillusionment with the ruling African National Congress Party, the ANC. Some polls suggest the ruling party could lose its majority, which it has held since the country's first democratic elections in 1994. The ANC has accused the Democratic Alliance of giving up the country's sovereignty on a silver platter. Earlier, I spoke to Kofi Kwaku, Africa political analyst and senior research fellow at the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg. I started by asking him what exactly the opposition is requesting.
The letter that they've sent out is a follow-up letter to another letter that was sent by the multi-party coalition group. At the heart of this request is a sense and the underlining idea that the elections won't be free. They haven't shown any evidence that really supports their concerns to say why South Africa needs all these international observers and, of course, also domestic observers to increase their numbers. So far, their position is very, very weak. They don't tell us why they think the electoral process is suspicious.
Interesting. And, you know, DA has really been making inroads in past elections and to a certain extent has been seen to be, you know, for once, providing formidable competition to the ruling ANC party. Of course, the jury's out there. But do you think this move could backfire or work against the DA?
Yes, it has already backfired. In fact, it sort of tarnished the image of the DA as some kind of conspiracy group or political party that is also some kind of fifth column of the United States and the West and South Africa. President himself was saying it last month that he fears that there may be some kind of foreign forces plotting for a color revolution in South Africa for a regime change. And of course, he didn't mention the name, but many of us who've been following this can tell you who it is that he's sort of pointing to, the United States or European countries.
And has the South African electoral process historically, you know, since the return of multi-party democracy in 1994, has it always been clean?
It's been unquestionable so far. There may have been some skirmishes at places to vote or some voting places have opened late. But so far, there's great confidence in the process and the system.
And for the first time that the ANC goes to the polls in a couple of months, it's going to be really facing a test, you know, gain majority in the last six general elections. Do you think, Kofi, you know, the ANC for the very first time could lose the majority in these elections?
Yes, there's plenty of evidence for it. And this is exactly why many of us who've been analyzing the situation don't understand why the DA, instead of working on the weaknesses, there's a basket of weaknesses of the African National Congress on the economy, on service delivery. I mean, there's such a list that it's just surprising that the Democratic Alliance and other political parties are not really capitalizing on those basket of weaknesses. The African National Congress is most likely to lose the majority this year because of the poor records that they've accumulated over the past 10 years. That's for sure.
Kofi Kwaku of the Center for Africa-China Studies at the University of Johannesburg. As we heard, the opposition Democratic Alliance have been under fire since they released the letter, with many asking what evidence they have. I spoke to Emma Powell, the DA spokesperson on international relations, and started by asking, why come out with this letter now?
This national election will be the most crucial election to take place in our country since the dawn of democracy. Millions of South Africans now live in grinding poverty. They are unable to access even the most basic of government services, and they navigate up to 11 hours a day of rolling blackouts. So for the first time since 1994, the ruling party, the African National Congress, face losing their 50% majority. And it is for this reason that as a nation, we have got everything to play for and everything to lose. It's a very large country. We have 9 provinces or states. We have about 24,000 individual voting stations. And it is simply not possible for any single party to make sure that they have got boots on the ground in terms of deploying a party agent to monitor the voting process and the counting process at all 24,000 stations. We're quite astonished by the ferocious response of the ANC. I mean, the ANC have gone so far as to appear on international channels like Russia Today, asserting that the DA is selling the sovereignty of South Africa to the USA by inviting domestic monitors. If the ANC had nothing to hide, they would have no problem with the close scrutiny of these elections.
You know, Emma, this move has largely caused a lot of anxiety, you know, the decision to actually reach out for external support. I guess this is unprecedented. It's never happened in South Africa before. And it's already being misconstrued as casting aspersions on the integrity of the Electoral Commission and its capacity to deliver a free and fair election. That is yet actually to happen.
Well, we have said on the record numerous times, and it's contained in the letter that was sent by the multi-party charter, that at a structural level, we have utmost faith in the IEC. We don't believe that the IEC will attempt to work with any political actor at a national or structural level in a way that may jeopardize the freedom and fairness of the elections. But let me go back to these 24,000 stations. We know that at the granular level of individual voting stations, anomalies do take place.
I've listened to you, and I guess the sense that you're alluding to the fact that there's a possibility that we're going to be having maybe external actors sort of like trying to influence the outcome of the forthcoming elections. If that's the case, do you have any evidence to substantiate, you know, those claims?
Well, we are obviously worried about foreign interference, and we are correct to be worried about foreign interference. We have seen this play out across the world in various elections and, of course, in various coup d'etats that have taken place from an African perspective, most recently in the Sahel region and West Africa. We are already seeing on social media the use of what we're seeing as coordinated misinformation campaigns. We also know from declarations that the ANC have made to the IEC, we have to, as parties, disclose our funding streams, that they are receiving money from certain individuals that are linked to the Kremlin. And most recently, their declaration for the last quarter was made under the smokescreen of the ANC's business arm, Chancellor House. So whilst they did submit a declaration, there was a smokescreen. Chancellor House is the ANC's business arm. So they said, okay, well, Chancellor House donated the ANC 10 million rand, but someone donated that money to Chancellor House. So the ANC are employing all sorts of very questionable, nefarious tactics to try and get around disclosing where it is that they are currently receiving their funding.
I don't know how this is perceived, especially, you know, in South Africa. Don't you think that this is counterproductive and probably could work against you?
We work with all sorts of independent organizations who monitor communications and who are able to tell us where things are coming from and where things are headed. And what we see is that much of the rhetoric that is in opposition and that has been shouting quite loudly in the corner around, oh, the DA is trying to sell the sovereignty of South Africa to the United States, which is just the most bizarre concept. These people are already not DA supporters, and they're also largely operating within echo chambers. And I don't believe that this will move the needle in any negative way. In fact, I think that it sends a very positive message to our support base, to potential supporters, and to the international community of democracies. This harms nobody and it benefits everybody.
Emma Paul, the DA's spokesperson on international relations. To Ghana now, where the government there is keen on reviving and growing its film industry that has largely been in the shadows of Nigeria's Nollywood. Filmmakers will now enjoy a 20% tax rebate as the country seeks to position itself as the preferred destination for film production. The tax incentives include exemption on import duty for production equipment, among other waivers, as the country diversifies its revenue streams. Ghana has garnered attention as an ideal filming location for notable production such as The Woman King and the BBC series Black Earth Rising. To get a better understanding of this ambitious initiative, I called up Juliet Yah Asantewa Asante, the National Filming Authority of Ghana, Chief Executive Officer.
Julia, just before we delve into, you know, the state of Ghana's film industry, could you just tell us what the tax rebate means and what it would entail?
Right. I mean, this is something that we have been pursuing for a while and is anchored under Ghana's proposition to position as a film hub and a shooting destination. And so Ghana is looking at the tax incentive in an interesting way. We are looking at it in a two-prong manner. One prong is that you will be exempted at the onset or at the front end. And so if you're bringing your equipment into the country, you will be exempted from importation taxes, which can be quite high. You know, you're working in Ghana or shooting your film or developing your content in Ghana, you will be exempted from VAT and all the other taxes like levies and COVID levies and all of those things. And so there are even some instances where you may be exempted from some kind of income tax. What I've described is applicable to all manner of productions with no qualifying spend. But at the high end, we also have projected a 20% rebate for productions that are above $10 million. Corporates that also contribute to the film industry also will have some tax waivers and levies and all of those. We are looking at this going through cabinet and parliament and then to be ready to roll.
The timing, why now?
It's been going on for a while. As a filmmaker myself, I'm a filmmaker and the sector has, you know, had some stagnation. So you're looking at what can really revamp the sector. Ghana has a good skill set profile. Ghana has a good equipment profile. Ghana is safe. I think second country on the global peace index. Ghana has various different sceneries.
You just talked about what Ghana has to offer. And one of the things that you've mentioned about the sceneries, what are some of the best locations that do fit the purpose of film directing in Ghana?
I mean, Ghana, for instance, has over 60% of the forts and castles on the African continent. Ghana has it all, whether you're looking for a chop bar to shoot in or whether you're looking for a high-rise building, Ghana has it. Ghana also has stable electricity, you know, in the sub-region. So there are many, many places that, depending on the film, depending on the story.
Help me understand, how big is Ghana's film industry? I know that, we talk a lot about, Nollywood from just across to the east in Nigeria. Just how big is the film industry and is it influential?
You know, if you go back to the 2001 UNESCO report, Ghana is actually the second largest producer of content on the continent following Nigeria. And so according to that report by UNESCO, Ghana produces 600 to its 35 plus million people and Nigeria to its population produces 2,500. And so even if you look at by ratio, Ghana is not doing badly at all. Ghana has one of the oldest training schools, the National Film and Television Institute, which is now a university, UNIMAC. Also in history, you find that quite a number of big budget films have been shot in Ghana, from Beast of No Nation to Deadly Voyage that I myself was in. And we know that the sector, according to this same report, is the largest employer on the continent. The median age in Ghana is 18.
I mean, you're very persuasive, Juliet. You sound so passionate about, you know, the Ghanaian film industry. So you mentioned something like you played a role. Are you an actress? And if you are, what was your role in that movie that you mentioned?
So yes, I started in this business over 30 years ago as an actress. And I was in Deadly Voyage. Deadly Voyage was a story of a stowaway on a ship, and it was played by Omar Epps, led by Omar Epps, Sean Petwee, and so many other actors who are now really doing very well. And with time, obviously, seeing the decline of the sector, I kind of took it on myself to pretty much get into policy, the policy arena, to try and tackle the problem that myself and my colleagues faced. And so I stepped back. If you go back to the same unit, UNESCO report, you will find that over 40% of African countries do not have a film commission. And so Ghana setting up a film commission by itself is a big achievement. And this is our fourth year.
Well, that's really great. I mean, excellent. And one of the other developments, because a lot of people see potential in Ghana's film industry. And just last year, I think must have been in the month of March, you know, Hollywood star Idris Elba did visit the country and made an announcement that he's considering building a film studio in the country. What was the reaction to that announcement? Just talk me through that investment. How is it going?
Idris, you know, has been working closely with us and kind of putting his voice into the arena. Others as well have put their voice to the agenda. From our own projection, Ghana can take about 3 or 4 studios to not just serve Ghana, but to serve the entire sub-region. So we're excited about that. Conversations are ongoing around identifying land, because obviously studios require big plots of uninterrupted land and hopefully near enough the city and with all the right infrastructures. And we also know that players, including Idris, is working on raising funds and finding investors for those projects.
And finally, Julia, do you think some of these initiatives that you have mentioned in the course of this discussion will be able to resolve some of the challenges that filmmakers do face in Ghana?
Of course, opportunity is the key word here. Innovation, collaborations. And if you follow us, you would know that we launched 2 important agendas, the Shoot in Ghana agenda and the Cinema agenda. One is targeted at production or development, the beginning of the value chain, and one is targeted at the marketplace and growing the marketplace. I'm sure recently you saw the very successful Super Bowl advert that was shot in Ghana for the Super Bowl, and that, you know, hit over 500 million views. And definitely having Ghana on the world stage like that, played during prime time during the Super Bowl, was a big win for us. And so we are already beginning to see some good results from our campaign. We are really, really excited. And we say this, Ghana is looking to produce content or be the vehicle or venue for producing content, not just for the global community, but especially for Africans, because, you know, we need to develop content that looks like us, feel like us, from young people, from children, children's programming to adult programming to whatever. Africa needs content that tells its story and changes its narrative. And those are some of the things that we are focused on enabling.
Juliet Yah, Asantewa Asante, the National Filming Authority of Ghana, Chief Executive. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Lola Shrua, Stefanio Kereke, Alfonso Daniels, and Yvette Tokira Maria. Paul Bachbinga was in charge, and the technical producers were Chris Ablakwa and Gabriel O'Regan. Andre Lombard is the editor. Don't forget to tune in to our sister podcast, Africa Daily. Tomorrow's edition looks at Nollywood actors. Why are they struggling financially in their old age? I'm Richard Kagoe.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.